we were a bit off thing. Okay. So, you know, I follow a handout, and I hope you all have it. And just now when I was looking at it, I realized that it's nicely divided into four columns. And the first column is essentially a review. The second column is trivial things. The third column is hard things. And the fourth column is things that I don't know yet. So it's really kind of a very nice division. Anyway, let's start with the plan. So again, I'm going back to 4D. I will tell you about W knots, which are really simply knotted knots. I'll review what that is in a minute. And I will tell you that it's related to Kashiwara Verne, but I will also tell you that I don't know how to go beyond simply knotted, though there are indications that you can. Okay? And again, I remind you of the sort of four topics, sort of topology, combinatorics, high algebra, low algebra. So topology is algebraic structures arising in topology. You can take their associated grade and then you get to spaces of diagrams, which is combinatorics. Given in the algebra, these spaces of diagrams tend to represent tensors, differential operators, something in the universal enveloping algebra. They basically represent formulas. So this is the low algebra, and the high algebra is the construction of an expansion going from here to here. Okay? So we will talk about two of them today, and one will be ridiculously low, and the other will be too high. Okay? And let me remind you what are simple two knots. So two knots in R4, when you project them to R3, look like surfaces with intersections, where in the fourth dimension, one side of the intersection, at every intersection, the actual things that go through it are layered relative to the t-coordinate. Simple two knots are when the surfaces only have intersections of this kind, double point and nothing more. And of course, one of the sides goes over the other in the fourth coordinate. And we talked about two examples 4 days ago, and maybe more, and I don't want to say anything about them, I just want to remind you that that's what a two-knot looks like. So if you have questions, that's an excellent time.
So it's always a sphere, or it's any surface?
No, not necessarily. So the formalism can represent other surfaces. I'll go through the formalism in a minute, and it can represent other surfaces as well, and also long tubes, so infinite tubes that, you know, go from minus infinity to infinity, and you may have several of them. Or it may represent spheres, or it may represent like one-sided tubes. So essentially a tube which is capped on one side and goes to infinity on the other side, and you may as well think of it as a tethered balloon, so a balloon with a, right, because if you pull it to infinity, then this is a sphere with a string, so you can think of it as a balloon with a line, okay, with a string. So, okay. But these are simple spheres, yes.
So when you talk about the space of W knots, you mean knots of all different origin types? Or?
Typically, when I will write KW, I will mean generic. I will mean anything or something specific, or I will mean the family, okay? And then if I want to restrict my attention to some part of the family, I will add here in parentheses the skeleton. So, you know, if I write arrow sub n, so this means a long line which represents a tube. So this will mean n tubes. If I will write here an arrow with a cap, a thing with a cap on it, at the end, this will mean a tethered sphere, right? If I will write, so a balloon with a string, if I will write a line with caps on both ends, it will mean a sphere. So, okay? Okay, nothing to add. And again, there is some combinatorial way to present the space of simple knots. And it involves generators, so there is the crossing and the virtual crossing and the cap, okay? And there is a two-step procedure to see what they represent. So first inflation gives bands which may intersect, as here, or which go past each other, as here, or which are capped past here, as here. And second inflation gives either this picture or that picture, or, well, it's not really shown, but a capped tube, okay? And then you can assemble these things together, like here, to get a long tube. This is a knotted long tube, or like here, to get a knotted sphere, okay? And notice that the crossing has some asymmetry in it. So the three-dimensional crossing, which is denoted by the exact same symbol, is in some sense symmetric relative to the two strands, because, you know, I mean, one strand is over the other, but if you look from below the page, they reverse roles. But there is no such thing in 4D. The lower strand represents the narrower tube, which goes through the bigger tube, or if you want, the smaller ring, which flies through the bigger ring, and there is no other perspective from which it looks different. Okay? So there is genuine asymmetry between the two sides. Next, so again, the set of W knotted objects is the planar algebra generated by these objects that I mentioned. Modulo, lots and lots of relations, and it's fun to verify these relations, but let me only point out that these relations are indeed not symmetric relative to the role of the over and under strand. So you can see this asymmetry in two places. So first of all, you can, if you have a strand going over another one where the other one is capped, you can pull it to the other side. Basically, it's like in this picture, if this side is capped, or maybe the top side, okay? If the top side is capped, you can just slide it under, slide it through to the until the two do not cross. However, if the other side, if the blue one is capped, then you're stuck. There's nothing you can do. You know, I hate to show you the picture, but the picture is like you have a cap and something goes through the neck. There is no way to let it to get it through. Okay? So this is the asymmetry. There is this cap-pull relation on this side, but there is no cap-pull relation if the horizontal strand is under. Okay? And similarly, there is an overcrossings commute relation here, which is explained locally by this picture, but there is no undercrossing commute relation, and the absence of it is explained by that picture. Okay? Good. And then there is a big open problem. This double inflation map can be shown to be onto, but it is not known if we found all the relations. And as I mentioned, and now there is a reference, there is a recent preprint by Kawauchi, and it may or may not have the answer in it. Okay? But at least when you read it superficially, it seems to have an answer. Okay? So for me, W knots will be this combinatorial gadget, regardless of whether it represents topology or not. Okay? So all the intuition for the relations comes from topology. Good. Done with review, and now easy stuff. Okay? So, well, I want to do finite type invariants just like I did in R3. So in R3, the key, so again, I could go through augmentation ideals and all that, but I think it will be easier to imitate, and you'll get the same answer, but I think it will be easier to imitate the R3 story. So in the R3 story, we had a double point, and the double point really represented the difference between an over and an under crossing. So now, when I have two strands, I have three ways to trade places. So one way is sort of the overcrossing. The other way is the virtual crossing. And the third way is the undercrossing. Okay? So I will declare that the difference between these two is the thing called a double point, or the thing replacing the double point, and it is often called the semi-virtual crossing. So it is semi-virtual. This side is virtual, this side is not. Okay? And for the difference between these two, I don't need the name, because it's just this one rotated 90 degrees. Okay? Good. So again, the semi-virtual crossing is over minus under. And then I play the same game as three or four lectures ago, and look at finite type invariants, things that vanish when you have n of n plus 1 of z's, then you look at the nth derivative of a finite type invariant, and it turns out to be independent of the topology, or depending only on the combinatorics, which amounts to saying that it depends on the underlying chord diagram, except the notion of chords become asymmetric now, because there is a distinction. So over here, the two strands play similar roles, but over here there is a distinction between the two strands. One is on the virtual side, there is no distinction, but on the classical side, one is over and one is under. So the combinatorial symbol for such a thing would be an arrow going from the upper strand to the lower strand, so in the skeleton. So if the strands are A and B, correspondingly, I will have an arrow from line A to line B. Okay? Now, strictly speaking, things should be oriented, and then there is also a sign for each crossing. This could be either a positive crossing or a negative crossing. So there should be a sign here as well. The signs disappear very quickly. Very quickly, one can show that the signs somehow are irrelevant, so I will just drop them. I will not even mention them. So more precisely, my arrows are always with positive signs on them, and they are enough. Okay? Good. So now there are relations. And there is a 4T relation, which is derived in exactly the same, well, sorry, not quite exactly, in a very similar way to the 4T relation of U-knots, of ordinary knots, okay? Namely, if you have so again, for ordinary knots, I think I drew it twice already. You know, you look at a double point and put a lasso around it and flip it to the other side. So for us, we put a semi-virtual crossing and put a lasso around it, and I claim that I can pull it out. What means pull out? Pull out means, well, okay, the semi-virtual is really a difference between a positive crossing and a virtual crossing. So when you think of it as if you look at the honest crossing, then you can pull it out using RiderMaster 3. If you look at the virtual crossing, which appears here, the term which involves a virtual crossing, you can pull it out using overcrossings commute. So therefore, you can pull out the lasso, and then you can bring it in virtually. You can check that the available moves are there, the necessary moves are there. Okay? So this is equal to this. But on the other hand, I could get from here to here by turning this crossing into virtual, and then this one into virtual, and then this one here to virtual. Each one of them is a semi-virtual. So I get a relation just like in the U case, but the relation looks exactly the same, namely, there is one arrow that is always the same, this arrow, and another arrow starts from a third location and ends either before or after the head of the first arrow, or either before or after the tail of the first arrow. Now, this relation is not symmetric. The arrow that moves around, this one, here, 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 has its head towards the arrow, the stationary arrow. The same relation with this arrow reversed, meaning with the tail facing the stationary arrow, is false. Because if I were to derive it, I would have to use over here undercrossings commute, which does not hold. Okay? So this is one relation. Another relation comes from this picture, which you can check is holds. From this equality, which you can check holds, and it becomes tails commute, so the tails of arrows commute. You can just slide tails past each other, but not heads, or not heads over tails, only tails past each other. And the last relation comes from the cup-pull relation, and it just says that if you have an arrow head right next to a cup, the diagram is equal to zero. But this is again asymmetric, not if you have a tail next to a cup. And again, this represents simple topological realities. Okay. So this is the end of combinatorics. This is combinatorics, right? We had topology, we talked about it. This is combinatorics. Now come, later low algebra will come, but now come high algebra. But high algebra in this instance is ridiculously low, okay? So I need to define an expansion. So I need to define a function z going from kw into aw, and I want it to be compatible with all available operations, meaning multiplicative, meaning I really need only to define it on the overcrossing, actually also on the virtual crossing, and I should have told you what the philosophy of virtual crossings is, but I didn't. Virtual crossings don't really exist. They don't really matter. So this is somehow fourth, and the value here will be simply the empty core diagram, arrow diagram, no arrows. But I still need to define z of a crossing. So z of a crossing, I hereby declare it to be, you take the two strands, A and B, and connect them by an exponential of arrows. So this thing means a bundle of arrows. Bundle means, or a quiver of arrows. Quiver like in the Lord of the Rings, okay, not like in mathematics. A quiver is a bag to carry arrows, okay? So, or a bundle is really a bunch of arrows. So what this means, when I say an exponential bundle of arrows, it means that it's a big linear combination. First term is no arrows, Second term is one arrow. Next term is two parallel arrows with coefficient 1/2. Next term is three parallel arrows with coefficients coefficient 1/3, and you can guess the rest. Okay? So if you have a general W naught, so here is a general W naught, it has several ordinary crossings and two virtual crossings. What you do, because of multiplicativity, you are forced to simply put an exponential of arrows next to each of the real crossings. Now, this is now really a long line with lots and lots and lots of arrows in it. You sort of expand using multilinearity. So, you know, this is one summation, this is another infinite summation, this is another infinite summation. It's a big, big, big sum. Yes, Pascal?
Or, sorry, I have a conceptual question.
Yeah.
There is something I miss. It's like, so yesterday you defined, in the case of usual knots, three-dimensional knots, you didn't define Z on just the crossing, or did you? I mean, yesterday you did on this algebra generated by the trivalent graphs, trivalent embedded knot.
Right.
And there you say, okay.
Maybe I should have said that. You know, this is sort of dream come true.
Okay.
Because here is a false dream. Okay? So, you know, equally well, I could have said usual knots, KU, is the planar algebra generated by just a crossing, or maybe plus or minus crossing, but I mean, essentially this. Modulo sum relations, right? And then I could have asked myself, can I define an expansion from this definition? And the answer, well, and then you would have to have a Z of a crossing, and it would have to be, I don't know what, something. But this is a dream come false, because you can't. There is simply no expansion of usual knots, which is defined on the planar algebra and is multiplicative under planar algebra operations. So therefore, you have to work harder and, you know, do roundabout things and either talk about parenthesized tangles or talk about multi-trivalent graphs, and then the generators are different, and then things work. But the simple-minded things that you wish would work just doesn't. Okay? And this is sort of the great advantage of W knots, okay? They are in some sense way simpler than ordinary knots. Because the simple-minded thing works. Okay? Did I answer?
Yes, but then I have another question. I'm a bit lost with in the case of knots we have this you have this Z going to this algebra A of Gauss diagrams. And here I do not get how you get so many vertical arrows. So when you say Z of a crossing, it's like we have like a that's sort of a curve diagram, right? A generalized curve diagram.
Yeah.
But what means is to these vertical arrows?
Which these vertical arrows?
Right.
Different parts of the skeleton. So the skeleton right. of the knot has many, you know, I'm marking different parts of the skeleton and putting many arrows between them. Now,
so you mean you choose a surface, which could be a long tube or whatever.
Yeah.
And for that, you have like a skeleton corresponding to the shape of that surface.
Yes. These are okay. Arrows connecting parts of the surface.
Right. Okay.
And then later, when I use planar algebra operations, so. You know, in principle, okay, let's compute the invariant of the trefoil. So, the invariant of the trefoil is, okay, let's write the trefoil first of all. Here is the trefoil, okay? So, I should first see it as a disjoint union of three crossings, right? So here are the three crossings. Each one of them really goes to an exponential of arrows, okay? And then I need to, so an arrow with a slash on it, which means an exponential. And then I really need to connect the ends as they are connected in the trefoil. But the easiest way to do it is to just put the exponential here, like do it in place. I put the exponential here and I put another exponential here, independent, and then another exponential here. And then I connect the ends. And now I have a skeleton which is a circle. Combinatorially, it's a circle. I lose the distinction. Right. Right. I lose the topology.
Right.
And I just have a circle, but on the circle there are three exponentials of arrows. If I were to unwrap the circle, to unwind it, okay, because it's just combinatorics now. So it will be a circle with one exponential going from here to here, another exponential going from here to here, and another exponential going from, I don't know what, maybe here to here. Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, this is rough. This is not meant to be precise. Okay? Well, okay, sorry. Wishful thinking should be proved. Okay? So I claim this actually works. So I need to check the Rademeister 3 move, right? What's the Rademeister 3, or the hardest relation is the Rademeister 3. I also need to check all others, but the only hard one is Rademeister 3, okay? So what's the Rademeister 3 relation? I should have drawn it on the handout, but give me credit for preparing it in one morning. Copy-pasting it from other places in one morning. But anyway, what's the Rademeister 3 move? It's something like this. This is equal to that. Okay? So, strand 1 goes over strand 2, then strand 1 goes over strand 3, 1, 2, 3, then 2 goes over 3. So each of these will become an exponential, so if I straighten it, I'll have an exponential of arrows going from 1 over 3, and then another one from 1 over 2, then another one from 1 over 3, then another one from 2 over 3. So this is the left-hand side of the Rademeister move. Now, tails commute. When two things commute, the product of the exponentials is the exponential of the sum. So I could rewrite this as the exponential of the sum of the of taking the tail always on the left, but putting the head either on 2 or on 3. Then the 4T relation really says that this whole arrow commutes with this sum. This is exactly what the 4T relation says. So I can slide. So I can slide all of these arrows down to the other side. So I get to this picture. But now, again I use tail commute to unexpand this exponent, to expand this exponential. And I'll expand it the other way and I'll come to this. But if you look at this, this is the other side of Rademeister 3, and this is the end of high algebra. Okay, I had an equation, Rademeister 3, with an unknown, the value of the crossing. I solved it, the solution is e to the x, and here is the proof that e to the x satisfies the relation. Okay? So in U theory, the first step fails. The first step, you cannot combine, these things do not commute, and you cannot combine them. And in fact, if you try to combine them, then you have to use the BCH formula, and you're lost. Okay? Okay. Okay, so this is excellent, except, so I have an invariant with values in AW, but I still want to understand AW. What is AW? It's a combinatorially defined space, but it's hard to analyze. So again, I have an advantage over AU. For AU, the answer was, here is a list of dimensions computed by computer. Here I have a much better understanding. Okay? So first of all, there is a bracket rise theorem, which is essentially the same and is proven in exactly the same way. So the space AW of arrow diagrams modulo 4T and tail commute is isomorphic to the space of diagrams like this. Well, I wrote one skeleton component, but I really meant there could have been many. Okay? And the diagrams are made of, well, the skeleton, and then connected to it, a purple graph, which is trivalent, in which all vertices are either on the skeleton, and they can be either outgoing arrows or incoming arrows, or they are internal, and if they are internal, they are always two in, one out. Two arrows go in, one goes out. Okay? The vertices, the internal vertices are still oriented. So like of the two incoming things, one is called the left and the other is called the right. And the convention is that when you draw it in the plane, left is on the left and right is on the right. Okay? And then the relations are, there is an anti-symmetry relation, there is a bunch of STU relations, and there is a bunch of IHX relations, and I have to tell you what they are. So, basically they are the directed versions of the relations, of the corresponding relations from U. Okay? So, if you have, if you want to commute two arrowheads, you write a Y diagram on the left. You must have an incoming arrow here and an incoming arrow here. So since you have two in, one out, this must be a downgoing arrow. If you want to commute a head with a tail, you must have an incoming arrow here, an outgoing arrow here. So since you already have one in, one out, this must be an in vertex, so the direction is forced. An in arrow, so the direction is forced. If you want to commute two tails, then there's just nothing you can write on the left-hand side, so it's zero. There's something called virtual knots, and in virtual knots, this will not be zero. And finally, IHX is the same as IHX, but with orientations, okay? And the proof is easy. So again, these diagrams contain the ordinary arrow diagrams, namely, just ordinary arrow diagrams are legal, okay? And then you can show that whenever you have a diagram like this, using these relations, you can collapse it to a linear combination of arrow diagrams. So basically, you know, you want to collapse this vertex, you use STU2. You want to collapse this edge, you use STU1. Okay? And you have to check that all ways of collapsing are equivalent, and this is exactly what the 4T relation gives you. This is a sketch, but that's more or less the proof. Okay, but that's terrific news. Because, you see, now, restrict your attention to a single connected component of the purple diagram. So of the purple piece. So this diagram has one connected component here, which is a circle with a little tree heading into it. Another connected component here. A third one is this one, and a fourth one is this one. Each connected component is a unitrivalent graph. Right, it has both univalent, meaning the ends, and trivalent vertices, and it's two in, and the trivalent vertices are two in, one out. Very easy to check that the only unitrivalent graphs are trees and wheels of trees. So a tree is just what you think it is, and it has to be oriented towards a root. So here is a tree, and it has to be oriented towards a root, and that forces the orientation of everything else. And a wheel of trees is a wheel with trees around it. Okay? And everything has to be oriented towards the wheel. And the wheel itself has to be oriented when either counterclockwise or clockwise, I mean, it's combinatorics, it doesn't really matter. Okay? So that's a wheel of trees. But you see, the IHX relation tells you that if you have like a line here and a vertex going towards it, you can replace it by a longer line, either here or here. So basically, you can replace this by that minus the other way. So you can get rid of all the vertices which are not on the wheel itself. So you're simply left with hairy wheels, okay? But you see, these univalent ends connect to the skeleton somewhere. And if the skeleton had n components, I could mark this is connected to component 1, this is connected to 2, this is to 1, this is to 2, 1, 2, whatever. And likewise, for the trees, the ends must be connected to the skeleton, right? Because I'm talking about connected components of the purple thing. Mm-hmm. So this must be connected to component 1, 2, 1, 1, 2, I don't know. And even the head has to be connected to one of the components. So these are the diagrams that I see. Okay.
But you lost some information about the order.
I lost some information. And I'll have to work to regain it, but I'll just tell you what the answer is. Okay? And the answer comes out, AW of N strands comes out to be, trees really mean the Frilly algebra. So it's the Frilly algebra on N colors raised to the N because the head has a color too. This you sum with cyclic words which are labeled with n labels. So this you sum with cyclic words with n labels. And these combine with a very funny algebraic structure. When you multiply them, so you see, such AW is obviously an algebra, right? Because if you have a chord diagram, an arrow diagram, one arrow diagram, and another one, you can just, with the same number of strands, you can just concatenate them. Okay? So the product that comes from AW is a very funny, induces a very funny Lie structure on this. So there is a funny bracket on FLN to the N, it's called the tangential bracket, it's not just the component-wise bracket. But it has some natural meaning. It's what Alexei Vetrosyan called tangential derivations. Okay? But it's basically this space set theoretically with a funny bracket. And then it's semi-direct product, so it acts in a funny way on cyclic words, and you have to take the semi-direct product. That gives you a Lie algebra, and this Lie algebra somehow represents a single connected component. If you look at its universal envelope in Pin algebra, you get a complete description of AW. So this is a true theorem. Okay? And finally, our invariant zeta is always an exponential within this space. So if you take its logarithm, our invariant z. So if you take its logarithm and call it zeta, you get something in the Frilly algebra on n colors to the n times cyclic words with n colors, and this is sort of a relatively well understood space. You know, people can tell you all, well, then CW of n is basically free. There are basically no relations except cyclic. If the freely algebra on n generators, people can write explicit bases, people can compute the dimensions, write the generating function of the dimension. This is completely well understood space. And then the next thing that I can tell you, but I will not show you, is that this invariant zeta can be completely, so not only the target space is describable in easy terms, but also the invariant itself. There are easy formulas how to actually perform these compositions that occur here in the language of the freely algebra and cyclic words using standard formulas or natural formulas in the freely and cyclic word languages. And all of these are implemented on the computer, and if you want me to show you the invariant of the Borromean links, I don't know, something to degree 10, you know, I punch it into my computer and I can tell you the answer. Okay? And then the second point, which comes out of the bracketized theorem, is low algebra, which in our case is higher than high algebra. Okay? So the relationship to finite dimensional algebra, and this is the next thing I want to tell you. So even this is easy. Well, it's analogous to the U case, but easier. So in the U case, let me tell you why it's easier. In the U case, I wanted vertices to represent structure constants, and I wanted edges to, I don't know, represent contractions, okay? So really, the vertex, so you know what, maybe I'll first do the W case, which is actually easier. So this should represent the structure constant, but now it has orientations. So I can think of it as a tensor in GDU. I can use the orientations to label the tails with GDU and the heads with G. And the bracket is exactly a tensor in G-dual, tensor G-dual, tensor G. That's what the Lie bracket is, right? Because the Lie bracket is a homomorphism from G tensor G into G, because, well, it takes two elements of the Lie algebra and outputs one. Therefore, it's a tensor in G-dual, tensor G-dual, tensor G. Okay? So I have what to put on the vertex. Now I want to put something on the edge. The edge is directed, so I use the same convention. I need something to put on G-dual tensor G. Okay? In G-dual tensor G. But there is a canonical tensor in G-dual tensor G. It's called the identity. Okay? So now if you have a big complicated diagram, I can put these tensors on the vertices, essentially nothing on the edges, and contract. And then I get a number, or more, not quite a number because I didn't talk about the skeleton yet. Let me do the same thing in a basis, okay? Oh, maybe before that, the reason this didn't work for ordinary Lie algebras is that for ordinary Lie algebras, I had no preferred orientation, so this had to represent either something in G tensor G or in G dual tensor G dual, and in either case, you need a metric on the Lie algebra. And here I don't even need a metric. So this works for all Lie algebras. Finite dimensional, sorry. So now let me do it in a basis to make it a bit clearer, okay? So I claim, so choose a basis xi for the Lie algebra and the dual basis for the dual algebra. So in other words, phi I evaluated on xj should be the Kronecker delta, delta ij. With these things, the identity becomes a sum of phi I tensor xi. Okay? So now label each edge with an English letter, French letter, I don't care, Flemish letter, okay? And put the structure, so, okay, first of all, define the structure constants using the bracket of xi with xj is a linear combination of xk's with coefficients bijk, okay? And then put a bijk next to each vertex, but I didn't really mean bijk, I mean b labeled by the labels around it, indexed by the labels around it. So here it will be ijk, and here it will be klm, okay? And then a diagram like this will go to a sum over all the Flemish letters running from one to the dimension of the Lie algebra of the product of the structure constant symbols. So bijk, oops, it should have been bjik, times bklm. And then what you read along the line. Now, what you read along the line is, well, you sometimes see a tail which corresponds to an element of the dual, and sometimes you see a head which corresponds to an element of the Lie algebra. So you, when you read these things in the dual, you read something in the dual basis, and in the Lie algebra you read something in the basis. So here you see phi I, phi j, xn, xm, phi n, because it's the tail of the n strand, phi l, because it's the tail of the l strand. Okay? And that defines a word. But this word is not a word in the universal enveloping of the algebra of the Lie algebra, but it's a word in the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra sum its dual. So you get a word in U of G sum, G dual sum G. Okay? But now you want this process to respect all the relations we have. So the IHX relation is simply the Jacobi relation for the bracket, it's satisfied automatically. Okay? But what about the STU relations? The STU relations impose that, okay, elements of G dual should commute. So you see, G dual is not a Lie algebra. I mean, how could I even say the direct sum of the universal enveloping algebra of this? G dual is not even a Lie algebra. But now I know how it is, because its elements have to be commute, so I just take it as the commutative Lie algebra. Okay? Now, elements in the Lie algebra, their bracket, their commutator, so these are two elements in the Lie algebra, their commutator comes from the bracket. So this means that I just take the ordinary structure, ordinary Lie bracket on this G, as it was given. And finally, the bracket of an element with a dual element is given in a funny way by twisting the structure constants, by putting the structure constant somehow sideways. If you interpret it, this ends up meaning that the bracket of something in G dual with something in G is the coadjoint action of G on G dual. Every algebra acts on its dual automatically, and it's called the coadjoint action. And this is exactly the definition of the coadjoint action. So the Lie algebra that comes in here is the semi-direct product of G with G dual, where G dual is abelian, and G acts on G dual with the coadjoint action. So this algebra I usually call IG. It's sort of a double of G. Well, it's a double of G. It's sort of two copies of G, but with funny structure. Okay? By the way, if you want to know an example, also for the reason for the letter I, so think about SO3. So SO3 is rotations of space, The Lie algebra of SO3 is R3. The dual of R3 is again really R3. But with the abelian structure, it means that it describes translations. And now I'm talking about rotations, semi-direct product, translations, but that's exactly Euclidean symmetries, or often it's called the inhomogeneous SO3. And this is the ISO3 in various physics books, and therefore IG when you generalize. Okay? So again, for SO3, the algebra here is rotations and translations. Okay. Next. What else did I want to say here? Of course, this extends to multiple copies of the, to multiple skeleton pieces. And if you have, in general, so if you have AW of N skeleton pieces, it will map to the universal enveloping algebra of IG, tensor with itself N times. Okay. The next piece is that, and I want to go through it very, very briefly because I'm running out of time, but the next piece is, so you see, the universal enveloping of an algebra of IG can also be interpreted as a space of differential operators on the Lie algebra, on functions on the Lie algebra itself. Namely, so an element of G dual is simply a function on the Lie algebra. Right? So so it represents the differential operator of degree zero, which is multiplication by this function. You know, like in quantum mechanics, x represents the operator x hat, which is multiplication by x. Okay? So elements of G dual are multiplication operators. Elements of G, so if you have an element of the Lie algebra itself, it induces an infinitesimal rotation of G dual. So therefore it induces a vector field on G dual, but vector fields differentiate functions. So it's really differentiations in directions that are tangents to the tangent to the orbits of the action of G on G dual, on itself. So and then if you have a word made out of several X's and several phi's, you just think of it as a composition of the, so first you multiply by phi to the L's, then you differentiate in the tangential direction X to the N's, and so on. And overall, U of IG can be interpreted as a space of as a model for the space of tangential differential operators. Differential operators, all of whose derivatives are in the directions of the orbits. Okay? Again, think SO3, so you're only allowed to differentiate in directions parallel to the spheres. Okay, to the spheres around the origin. Okay, is this okay? Okay, now unfortunately everything has been too easy so far. Even high algebra was really, really, really low. So we have to go up and introduce vertices, and then we get, everything becomes equivalent to the work of Kashiwara Verne as seen by Alexei Ventorossi. So, what do I mean by vertices? I guess there are two types of vertices. There is a smooth vertex, which looks like a pair of pants, and it's actually not interesting. The theory extends to smooth vertices, but in an interesting way. It's still easy. And then there is the other vertex, which I described 4 days ago, which really stands in the flying ring pictures, two rings fly together, merge, become one, and fly as one. So this is singular. Sort of the parameter space is not a manifold, it's a so-called foam, so it's a graph cross S1, okay? And I want to extend to this type of vertices. You can check that for this type of vertices, there is one additional move, topological move. Again, this is not proven, but this is the only one we can see. And it's the Rademeister 4 move, which is when you can slide a lasso above a vertex or also below the vertex. For the smooth vertices, the symmetry is broken between above and below, and it's actually easier. Okay. You get a corresponding associated graded. The corresponding associated graded is arrow diagrams on top a skeleton which now may have vertices. And on the vertices, you get relations, and it's the same as the vertex invariance relation of last time. So you're basically, if you have an arrowhead near a vertex, you can slide it to the other side as a sum. And I wrote here an arrow going both ways because this works for both heads and tails. Okay? And then the not theoretic statement simplified to fit the page. So, you know, I didn't yet tell you about cups and cups interact in a strange way with vertices. So I didn't tell you about this at all, and I'm skipping it altogether because the time now is, I have 3.5 minutes to go. Okay? So basically I need to find, well, I already have a value for the crossing. I also need to find a value for the vertex. I need to put some value for the vertex in such a way that I can, such that Rademeister 4 will be satisfied, so that I can slide things under the vertex. It turns out that sliding things over the vertex is easy. So it's not a worry, okay? And in a diagrammatic language, it becomes the statement that you can put something on the vertex. So putting something on the vertex really means all around the vertex. So I can put chords all around the vertex, but using the vertex invariance relation, I can push all the arrows down to one side of the vertex, to just two legs of the vertex. So I need to put some big combinations of arrows, V, over here, so that if I compose it with the combination of arrows R, over here, where R is just the exponential of a single arrow, then this will be equal to, well, putting the V here and two copies of R down here. That's an equation to solve. Now, I very, very briefly, because I only have 2 minutes to go, this equation can be again interpreted as an equation in the universal enveloping algebra. So I'm looking for a V in the universal enveloping algebra of IG squared. Right, squared, because it lives on only two sides. And it has to satisfy some equation which has nice description in the language of universal enveloping algebra. Basically, some co-product of something is equal to something else. I don't know. Okay? This, again, can be interpreted as a finding a unitary, I don't know what a unitary tangential differential operator is, but it, when you translate it to the language of operators, it becomes, we are looking for a unitary operator which satisfies some property, unitary tangential. Okay? Now, a unitary operator is an equality of integrals, right? The norm before applying the operator is equal to the norm after applying the operator. So if you go through figuring out which equality of integrals it becomes the Kashiwara-Verne statement. And this is the 1 minute version of it. Okay? I still haven't solved. I only told you that finding V is equivalent to the Kashiwara-Verne problem. I still have to tell you how to solve for V. So this comes from the next line. So, and again, this is a very, very complicated thing compressed to one box. So you see, there really is a map from ordinary knots to W trivalent forms. You can read it elsewhere, but anyway. There really is a map going from here to here, and it induces a map on the associated gradients. And then you can ask yourself, and then you can challenge yourself with something harder. Can you find an expansion for this, and an expansion for this, which makes this diagram commutative? And that, in fact, is how you find this expansion, one way to find this expansion. Namely, the theory of associators here constructs this one, and this essentially forces the value of that one. Again, all details are missing. But in particular, this tells you why there is a relationship between Kashiwara-Verne and associators. A priori, they look like completely different algebraic topics. The reason they are related is because of this inflation map, which goes from 3D to 4D. Okay. Now, so far I've been talking about only two nodes that have this type of singularities, but two nodes may also have this type of singularities, namely triple points, or so-called branch points, which I don't want to talk about. And then you can ask yourself, does everything extend to arbitrary two knots? My tools completely fail. I have no idea if I only use this diagrammatic calculus. However, there is a quantum field theory that constructs invariants of two knots. And when you look at the Feynman diagrams for this quantum field theory, which represent configuration space integrals in similar manners to 2 days ago, when you look at the Feynman diagrams, they turn out to be exactly the same kind of diagrams. So, trivalent graphs, two in, one out, same relations, everything is the same. So this suggests, and the quantum field theory doesn't even know if the knot is simple or not. It's genuinely four-dimensional. It can't tell anything about the projection to R3. It doesn't care. So this suggests that everything should extend to arbitrary two knots, and I don't know how. So maybe I'll just tell you that I don't even know what finite-type invariants of two knots are. And I guess if I had another minute, I would tell you where to start. But beyond starting, I'm stuck. Okay? So there is a big open problem for anybody who wishes to do something. And here are all the references and my normal propaganda at the end. And I'll yes.
This IG that you have, this is like the Lie of the cotangent B group of G.
Yeah.
Is there a version of for the double of any Levi algebra instead of the trivial ones?
That's virtual knots, which I didn't talk about. Yes. It has no topological meaning, so it has only so. Okay, the short answer is yes, and I'll keep. Okay. Yes, with footnotes, and I'll keep it as that. Okay? Again, unless you insist.
Maybe I won't insist later.
Yes, with footnotes. The corresponding high algebra is the theory of quantization of Levi algebra. With footnotes. Yes?
Could you expand on the second issue?
That sorry? There are,
so if you go upwards to the issues, the second issue says that there are
many
more
configurations. Configuration space integrals, yes. So, okay. So, BF theory as written by Cataneo and Rossi, as analyzed by Cataneo and Rossi, suggests a certain type of configuration space integrals. And they are exactly the same, or they are parameterized by exactly the same Feynman diagrams as the diagrams that make up AW. Okay? But if you look at these ingredients that appear here, meaning integrations on the manifold, integration on the surface, pullbacks of three forms and pullbacks of one forms, if you look at these ingredients, you can assemble them in other ways, in ways that do not come from Feynman diagrams, from Feynman diagrams for BF. So in three dimensions, that's actually also true. So in three dimensions, you can also look at configuration space integrals that corresponds to diagrams that did not come from Chern-Simons theory. So for example, I don't know, you could look at diagrams that have a quadrivalent vertex. Same procedure works, right? And maybe, okay, let's make it more interesting. So a quadrivalent vertex here and a bivalent vertex here. You could look at such diagrams. But there is an easy way to prove that all such diagrams, except the ones you want, vanish. Okay, so this turns out to be not the forms degree don't match, these diagrams vanish, do not contribute. There is some symmetry that allows you to eliminate it, something. There are different diagrams, so there are different group rationales. In 4D, I can actually assemble these pieces in ways that correspond to integrals that do not vanish, or at least I don't know why they vanish, and that do not come from quantum field theory. So there's potential that, well, for example, it could be that Cataneo and Rossi found an observable, right? They write a quantum field theory and then they write an observable in it. The parallel of the holonomy, the trace of the holonomy, becomes some funny different observable. Maybe they missed something. Maybe there are other observables. Maybe BF theory can be slightly generalized. Okay, maybe there is more on the quantum field theory side. Now, you could have asked the same in three dimensions. Maybe there is more than just Chern-Simons. And the answer is, well, okay, maybe there is more than just Chern-Simons, but I don't care. Because Chern-Simons already constructs everything that can possibly be constructed by quantum field theory, by perturbative quantum field theory, because everything that would ever come out of perturbative quantum field theory would be finite type for very simple reasons. And Chern-Simons theory constructs all finite type invariants. So therefore, in 3D, I know I don't need to look for more. But in 4D, I don't have a finite type theory, so I don't know when to stop looking, and it may be that there is more. Okay? But again, BF theory suggests that at least cyclic wheels and free linear elements make sense. So at least the AW theory extends to all two knots. There might be more, but at least that much extends.
No further questions, so let's think.